You're listening to Bottom Shelf Bitcoin. This is episode 42. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, the podcast that puts Bitcoin knowledge within everyone's reach. As always, I'm your host, Josh Humphrey, and today my guest is J.W. Weatherman, creator of MathBot.com as well as 10hoursofbitcoin.com. J.W., welcome.
Thanks, man. Really happy to get together and chat.
Yeah. So before we get into the other stuff, why don't you give us a little bit of background, kind of your background and how you got into Bitcoin and this stuff?
Yeah, totally. So I have been in software security, I guess, broadly speaking, for about 20 years now. I worked for a big company, you know, Google, Twitter sort of place, and did that for many years. Got fairly senior, and then left and started a consulting company and did pretty well with that. And it was all basically software design security, you know, hacker sort of stuff. And that was my whole specialty, you know, when I was working in corporate America too. So I did that for several years, and then I decided that I kind of wanted to do software startups. So I did a couple software startups. And the cycle there is you basically create a product, you build a company around it, you sell the company to one of the bigger incumbent players, and then you become a VP at one of the big guys for a while, or, you know, something around there, senior director up through, you know, kind of senior VP. So you do that for a couple of years and then you leave because it's a big company and it's boring and they just killed your baby anyway. And then you do it again. So I went through that cycle and, I was actually, it was after I had left one of the companies that I had sold the previous company to that I finally got around to looking at Bitcoin. As a security guy, you know, you're pretty cynical about anything that says that it's unhackable. You just kind of write it off right off the bat. And, you know, I had heard about Bitcoin probably really early. I mean, I probably got introduced to it in 2010 or 11 or something. And, just thought, this is really dumb. I remember there was a security design review that was done of it by Dan Kaminsky. And I remember looking at that and thinking, oh, you know, this is interesting. He didn't find anything super obvious, but I'm sure it's still dumb and he just missed it. So that was my perspective on Bitcoin until, I don't know, about a year, 18 months ago. I had sold the company. I had some downtime and I thought, all right, I'm finally going to really dig into Bitcoin and figure out what's going on here. And the price was much higher at that point. It wasn't peaked yet when I started looking at it, but it was on the run up, and that probably helped get my attention too. That, gosh, this thing's still around, and, you know, the market cap is insane, and I'm sure it's dumb. I just wasn't sure 100% why yet. So the way that I went about that was I created a threat model, and a threat model is a security design review document that goes through all of the, it's not like a lot of times when people think of a hacker, it's the guy that just, if it was a building analogy, just walks up to the building and tries to jimmy open the window, right? This is more of looking at the architectural plans and saying, I don't really care about the details of how the window was installed, whether it was screwed in properly or not. I'm just going to look at it from a design, like an architectural plan level, and see where they made major design decisions. Like, oh, they designed this on purpose to have a 4-foot wall, and that's easy to climb over. So that's what a threat model or a security design review is of software. So I decided, all right, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to buckle down and burn through this thing. And that document is one of the things that's on 10hoursofbitcoin.com. But it was the thing that convinced me that this is incredible. This actually is going to work. And that might sound stupid because it's been around for 10 years, but there's a lot of flaky scams out there that can run for many years. So Theranos is in the news right now. It's an example of a company that raised a lot of money. It was always a scam. but it was able to run that scam for a long time because it was able, just like any, you know, essentially a Ponzi scheme, suck in new money and keep the old money happy enough that things were happening by spending that new money. So you're constantly raising new money. So in Silicon Valley, you know, the combination of my background, like Silicon Valley startup guy with security, like you probably couldn't design a more cynical person than that. So even though it had been around, I really did think it was garbage until I sat down and looked at it. And even then, when I published the threat model, I thought, there's probably still something that I'm missing. Like somebody's going to say, oh, but you forgot to look at this. And I was going to go, oh, that's where the hole is. So even for probably a month or two after I published the threat model, I was still not 100% sure, but I was probably 98% sure after I went through that process.
Gotcha. And you also have some kind of Austrian economics background, right? Prior to looking into Bitcoin, or was it kind of along the same time, or?
No. I got into Austrian economics about 10 years ago. And, I have done some academic work in the past. I've been a college professor and worked, in areas that were very related to Austrian economics, and got to teach some Austrian economics in that process at the university level. So I was kind of fairly well prepped on the economic side for Bitcoin. I was actually very well prepped, I think, in both areas, on the technology side and the economic side. And really the way that I, you know, rationalize not getting into it much earlier is I'd been presented with a ton of scams, and the people that presented Bitcoin to me presented it if somebody says, hey, there's gold over on the other side of the hill, and you ask some follow-up questions and you end up talking about aliens and the fourth dimension, you know, you just blow that off, right? You're like, yeah. All right, I'm not walking over the hill. That's a long way to go. So I think the people that had presented it to me were, it gave me the impression, and I'm not blaming it on them, I'm just explaining why I could be introduced to it and be competent and still have no interest in it. The impression that I got was it was sort of like a SETI at home sort of thing, combined with like Linden dollars is the way that I categorized it. And I didn't really think of it as a, like, one of the things that helped me a lot just think more clearly about it was I was reading something that Satoshi wrote, and he described it as if it was a new element that was discovered, right? Like a new type of metal, and this metal had certain properties. And I just didn't really give it, it wasn't presented to me in that sort of way, right? Like, hey, we've created this digital object that can't be copied and is scarce and is really, really hard to steal. That probably would have intrigued me, but I can't remember what the memes were around Bitcoin when it was first out, or when I got introduced to it, or, you know, maybe how those memes were a little messed up when they were translated to me. But I got the strong impression that it was really flaky. And, you know, the other thing that gives me some comfort is, having been around crypto Twitter for the last year and got to know a lot of the personalities, there's a lot of really flaky people in Bitcoin. And I think it's just because it's a rebellious activity, right? It's a fringe sort of cutting edge, but there's a rebelliousness to it. There's certainly an anti-governmentness to it. And I think those are good things, but I also think it attracts a lot of strange cats. So the guys that introduced me to Bitcoin were not the people that I respected in my industry, right? So that didn't help much. And I think that still goes on. I think there's a lot of, you know, guys sitting in their basement, just kind of being weirdos that are into Bitcoin, and that's fine. But it does make it a little harder at times, I think, to get up to speed.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, I think that's a good transition then into maybe why you created 10 Hours of Bitcoin. Like, why don't you kind of give us a basic overview of what it is and what was your motivation to create it?
Yeah, totally. So, I mean, one of the things that I've been called over the last year or so is like the most extreme Bitcoin maximalist, the maximalist, I think I've been introduced a couple times as. I think that's great, but it's a little bit silly, right? Because it makes it sound like it's this really, really extreme position. And And it's, my position isn't extreme at all. My position is just, I have a pretty good understanding of economics and I have a pretty good understanding of the technology. I know how open source software works. And when you combine all those things, you end up at a position that is, might seem extreme if you're being constantly bathed and washed in the propaganda the scams that are being put forth, right? There's a lot of marketing budget that doesn't want you to believe that Bitcoin is head and shoulders above the rest. Bitcoin has no marketing budget, but all of these other guys, they have a considerable marketing budget. So the question that that I started struggling with pretty early on after releasing the threat model and getting into it is, how do I get this? How do I kind of get this knowledge out? How do I help people understand what's going on here? And so I'd never been on social media before. That's what got me onto Twitter, was wanting to help people understand the threat model and help people understand that things like Bitcoin Cash are really attacks on Bitcoin. They're not just benign things. They're really damaging and slowing the adoption of a secure money. They're prolonging, you know, this, this environment where we're all using government currencies, even though they're claiming, of course, you know, their talking points are that they're not, they're actually a very negative thing. And as more people are deceived and sucked over, that's not good, right? That slows down us hopefully adopting a secure money. And, you know, hopefully this will have a big impact on human freedom. So in that way, those things are actually slowing down the abolition of the modern forms of slavery. So That's sort of my motivation. And I tried that a few different ways. I actually had part of the 10 hours of Bitcoin is a 3-hour series of lectures that that I put together, and I sold that as a course for $300. So you had to send me $300 in Bitcoin, and then Seif Edeen Amos and Eric Lombroso both showed up and did Q&A sessions as part of this. And you'd go through the lectures. We tried it in a couple different formats, but ultimately what I decided to do was take that and take the other things that I think people need, because I don't think that you can come up to speed on Bitcoin in an hour, but you also probably, if you're the average guy, don't have 100 hours to put into getting up to speed on Bitcoin. That's a huge investment. But 10 hours seems about to be about the right order of magnitude. So I thought, okay, I've got this 3 hours of content that I think is pretty solid. There's some other resources here that we can put together, and we'll just basically have the best 10 hours of content that any new person could start with, or anybody that's been around for a while could run through, to make sure that all of their foundations are solid and that they understand what's going on and don't get scammed. So that's what it is. It's basically a curated list of the first 10 hours that anybody should spend, or the most important 10 hours that anybody should spend to get up to speed on Bitcoin.
Gotcha. So, and let me, I'll just kind of read through these things real quick. So you've got, and I think what I really like about this is that, I was telling you earlier, I went through most of this in the last week. And honestly, I did most of it like while I was driving or during lunch breaks, because a lot of it is audio and, or you can read it. And actually, you, I don't think it's as catchy of a name, but, and it may be a little deceiving, but you could put most of this stuff on 2x. So you could probably squinch it down to like 5 or 6 hours. But
Totally. You can listen to it at 1.5 speed, no problem. And everything is at a minimum, you can listen to everything. So if you want to just listen to it, that's fine. Some of the stuff is audio as well. And some of the stuff you can read. So like Nick Szabo's paper on the origins of money, you can listen to that. The Crypto Economy Guy did a great audio version of it. Or if you want, you can read it. But at a minimum, you can listen to everything that's on there.
Yeah, you've got the prologue from the Bitcoin Standard. You've got your 3 hours section on here. This Bitcoin Under the Hood video, which I actually hadn't watched up to this point. That was a really good explainer, I felt like. And then you've got, Nick Szabo's Origins of Money. And then Money, Blockchains, and Social Scalability. Is that also Nick Szabo?
Yeah, yep, it sure is.
And then you've got your Bitcoin Threat Model, the Human Threat Model, and then a couple things on Lightning Network, Simplicity Smart Contracts, and Liquid Sidechain. So that's kind of a very brief overview. I'm curious, so why do you, I think I know why, but why did you, okay, besides the prologue to the Bitcoin Standard, but like or let me ask it this way. Did you put these in this order intentionally?
Yeah, definitely. So the idea is, if somebody has never heard of Bitcoin, has no idea what's going on, just mildly curious, all the way to somebody that has been in the space for a long time, doesn't really feel like they have a total grasp on the economics. Or another way to say that is somebody that wouldn't consider themselves a Bitcoin maximalist, or is on the fence about Bitcoin maximalism. So people that have been in the space for a while, they'll know what I mean. From my perspective, that means you're just not totally comfortable with the economic arguments. You're not totally aware of how open source software works. And so you're still struggling to reconcile some things. So anybody in that spectrum is going to benefit from this. But if you're starting from absolute ground zero, I think the very best place that you can spend the first 10 minutes is listening to the prologue from the Bitcoin Standard. I think that's the best 10-minute introduction anywhere. And if anybody has anything that's better, we will be brutal curators, right? Like, I like Saif al-Din a lot. One of the things that was really encouraging to me early on is he wrote such a great book on Bitcoin, and he referenced the Bitcoin threat model and used that as a support for his arguments and understanding of security. So I'm a big fan of Saif. Like I said before, he was coming in and doing 1-hour Q&As with the very kind of first, let's say, prototype of what is 10hoursofbitcoin.com. But that said, if anybody has the better 10 minutes to hit somebody with when they're starting from scratch, we will brutally tear that off and put that up there instead. But as I understand it, and the best resource that I've seen so far, that's the best place to go. He does a really succinct and brilliant job of explaining where Bitcoin is at this point in time. So very, very intentional in thinking about how to bring somebody up and through the arguments. The next section is my 3 hours of Bitcoin and economics lectures. And that assumes that you're starting from basically ground zero as well. So at the end of that, you have a pretty good idea of what money is, what barter is, what a unit of account, the idea that the scammers are going to be able to convince you that one part of money can exist, like a store of value, and that can be separated out, and something else can be the medium of exchange, which is a big talking point in this last round of scams that we had to go through. And it still remains a big talking point with people like Andreas Antonopoulos. But once you go through those 3 hours of lecture, you're not going to be able to be deceived by that. You're going to understand that that's like saying a duck, has a can fly and is a bird, and people saying, well, we can separate out duckness into flyingness and birdness. No, we're talking about money here. And these are attributes of what money does, how money functions in society. They're descriptive terms. And when you understand that those are all descriptive terms that have to refer to the one thing that they're talking about, the duck or the money, then it's just a lot harder to deceive you. So that's the next section. Then we have, like you said, the Bitcoin under the hood. That one I would like to replace. I like it, but I think that soon somebody is going to do a better 30 or 60 minutes sort of overview. There's another great hour by 3 Blue, 1 Brown. And it's an hour sort of overview of Bitcoin, but it's a little too technical. He goes into the math. He's a math guy, so he goes into that a little bit too much.
Yeah, I've seen that one before. That one's good.
Yeah, it's not bad, but then at the end he does sort of endorse some crap coins, so that was a little disappointing. But I'm still on the fence. I mean, it was good enough to where the first version we actually had that one up there, but like I said, we're going to be brutal. So if anybody goes through this and says either I can make something that's better that covers this content, or I know of something that's better, just hit us up on Twitter. There's a feedback link. It'll take you right to the Twitter thread, and it'll be up there, within a day.
So
just to finish out real quick, I'll just say,
go ahead.
Yeah. So just to finish the overview, there's a couple of essays by Nick Szabo on the origin of money, and also a lecture called Money, Blockchains, and Social Scalability that are just excellent. Then there's a Bitcoin threat model from me explaining the different ways that you would try to attack Bitcoin if you wanted to destroy it, and why why it doesn't look like any of those would work. So that's really interesting. Then there's the human threat model. And basically, that's looking at humanity as an effort to make the world more delightful and all of the ways that you could try to hinder or break that and how Bitcoin plays into that. So at this point, you're kind of getting a lot more philosophical and you're looking at, why does this even matter? Why do we even care if we have a sound and secure money? And the answer is that right now we live in an environment that is a pretty sophisticated slavery, where instead of, you know, just hitting you with the whip and taking your stuff, we have taxation and we have inflation and we have these more sophisticated ways to take somebody and remove their wealth from them in a systematic way without their consent. And how Bitcoin can play into that and maybe be the tipping point to get rid of at least all the current versions of slavery. Somebody may come up with some lobotomized version, some nanotechnology in the future that changes human nature and makes us very easy to manipulate cows or something. But where we stand right now, we're at an interesting point in history where Bitcoin is enough of empowerment to the individual, and we don't have a lot of stuff that is fighting the other side, that we could actually end up in a place where we really don't have anything approaching slavery for maybe hundreds or thousands of years. So it's a pretty interesting way to kind of analyze the impact that Bitcoin might have. And then there's just a lecture on the Lightning Network, a lecture on simplicity, and a lecture on the Liquid sidechain to wrap it up. And the reason that I have those three, I'm ending with those three, is that if you have the right foundation, you'll understand that through Lightning and other technologies, Bitcoin can rapidly scale. Through simplicity, we're going to have really high quality smart contracts before anybody else, including Ethereum. And through Liquid, we have an example of how we can upgrade the system way, way more rapidly. And we can experiment faster and more aggressively on Bitcoin than anybody else is going to be able to do on their scam coins. So at the end of this 10 hours, you should be a pretty hardcore Bitcoin maximalist or I've done something wrong.
Nice. So I really appreciated going through yours, and this is what I really enjoyed about the Saifedean's book, The Bitcoin Standard, as well, is the understanding of what price is and what money is and this kind of economic understanding, because I think, so I knew about Bitcoin kind of right on the fringes of when I kind of started learning about libertarianism and Austrian economics. And then I learned about those. And then I think once I understood those, I went, this is why Bitcoin actually matters. And so I think there's so many people, I mean, the vast majority of people who don't actually understand money or price or anything about this. And I feel like when I try to explain Bitcoin to people, I end up having to like help them unlearn all of the garbage that's been stuffed in their head about money and economics and things. Like, it's just what they think they know is totally false or just like a twisted version of things. And you have to claw all of that out before they can start processing what's real.
Yeah, absolutely. There has been a lot of scam coins out there called government fiat, and they've had a lot of really effective scammers and court historians and academics. And they've really dominated economics for quite some time now. There was definitely a time where, not that long ago, 50 years ago, people would have been outraged by the idea that we were using anything other than gold or silver, something in a vault. The idea that the paper in and of itself didn't have to be backed by anything would have been completely absurd. But after a few years of government indoctrination through the public school system, people now think that it's completely acceptable and completely sustainable long term that the money that we have can be created by politicians at will. And they actually believe that even though the money could be created by politicians at will in theory, that there's some kind of separation of powers. Like the Federal Reserve is not beholden to the president, even though the president appoints him, and you know, that they're somehow so independent and they're so loving and caring for strangers that they would never inflate the money supply to their own advantage. They would only set interest rates for what's best for people that they don't know. And that sounds really absurd when you say it like that, but that is exactly what people leave high school, especially if they take economics courses in college. That's what they leave college believing, because they've been washed in it since they were, you know, 5 years old, in sometimes subtle ways and sometimes very overt ways. So it really is like cult deprogramming. When you try to get somebody to understand that it is possible to have a better money than what we have with government fiat, you really got to go all the way back to the basics and start from barter and just explain, this is how barter works. Now, here's the problems with barter. It doesn't work out as often as it should. It's not as efficient as it should be. And people really don't know what they have before and after. You're not able to calculate profits. There's all kinds of problems with barter, right? And then you slowly introduce the concept of money. And then you understand what money is, and then you slowly introduce the ways that money could be co-opted to basically provide legal tender slavery by making a population only use the money that you're permitting them to use, and then taking that money and producing more of it for yourself and your friends. But you can't start there. You really have to start at, like, you know, two dudes that just run into each other and want to trade some chickens for eggs or something very, very basic, and then work your way up. And the problem with that is that most people don't have an attention span that's long enough for it. So, right. A lot of people would rather, you know, like, there's going to be people that listen to this podcast and they're like, well, I know what's going on. You know, I've listened to a bunch of podcasts over the last year or whatever. But the problem is, in a 1 hour podcast, I can't be systematic. It would take me 3 hours, right? To be systematic and take you through it. And that would only be if I was lecturing, right? If it was a dialogue, it becomes 10 hours. And there's no way we can cover that 10 hours of bedrock, like, very basic economics content that everybody needs to know to think that I'm not a madman right now. There's just no way I can do that 3 hours of lecture, you know, 10 hours of discussion in a 1 hour podcast.
Right. So then, you know, if people go through, and I'm interested in this myself, you know, go through your 10 hours of Bitcoin, or even if they just go through that 3 hours, section, and they want to know more, like, have some more historical context for some of the things, like, maybe in the last 200 years in U.S. Like, federal financial economic policy. Do you have any good resources for that?
Oh man, that's a really good question. So I really like if you go through this 10 hours and you're motivated enough, it depends on how motivated you are. And so if you were super motivated and you were like, I'm going to be voracious about this, and I'm going to figure out what is really going on here, there's no better book than Human Action by Ludwig von Mises. It's an excellent tome. It is a lot to read, but what I tell people to do is read some of it and then listen to the podcast version of it. There's a free podcast if you just search for Human Action on iTunes or Stitcher. It's a free audio podcast of the audio version of this book. So it's a really, really great resource. I don't know how many hours it is. It's probably a lot more than 20, to listen to it, but that gives you a really, really solid understanding of socialism and how it came about. You know, all of the different implications of having a central bank. It is a very, very thorough and well-written book. I can't recommend that enough. But a step down from that, there's a book by Bob Murphy that is sort of a summary of Human Action. And I think that's probably, you know, a 10-hour read or something. It's called Cooperation Choice. I think if you just search for Choice Bob Murphy, it'll come up. And that's a really great resource. There may be an audio version of that. I'm not sure. I also like the Tom Woods podcast. The early episodes, especially the ones now, were good too. I was lucky enough to be a guest on his show and talk about MathBot a few months ago. But he does a really great job of just introducing a lot of the Austrian economics principles that you need, and covering specific topics, you know, because once you kind of start thinking about money as, or this form of taxation as slavery, right? Like the idea that the folks that rebelled from England and the United States had was that, I'm your slave if you can take my stuff without my permission. But if I vote for it, if I have some representation, then I'm not, right? Then I'm still a free man. I think that was a flawed concept. And I think Murray Rothbard is another great guy. Like anything that he's written, you know what? Actually, I would start with an essay that he wrote called Anatomy of the State.
Yeah, that's a good one.
By Murray Rothbard. But if you kind of understand what these guys have, all the academic work that they've done, you look at something like what, you know, the argument for rebelling against the British Empire, and you say, okay, you guys were right in the sense that, yes, if somebody can take your stuff without your permission, that is a form of slavery, no question about it. But the idea that if in a local area, you know, 55% of people vote to have their stuff taken in a certain way, that the 45% of people that don't consent, that wouldn't have voted for that, are somehow consenting, that argument falls short as well. So there's a lot of red pills kind of tied up in all of this. And part of the reason is, like you said, we've been indoctrinated to believe that it's in our best interest to have our stuff taken on a regular basis through all kinds of different methods. It's in our best interest to have our kids educated by the state so that they can get convinced of all of these same things. Because without the government, right, without the state basically monopolizing communication as much as possible, which has been fixed a lot with the internet, monopolizing education as much as they possibly can, which is hopefully being fixed with homeschooling and things like mathbot.com to make that easier. But without the government basically running every aspect of your life, it would be, you know, chaos and destruction, and we would all die. Those ideas are really, really stupid. But if you start being told them from a really young age, you are a member of the cult. You are fully indoctrinated, and it is really, really hard to get out of it. So I think a lot of people, they get into Bitcoin or they get into some aspect of economics, and once they realize that this stuff is all tied up together, they do fall into this rabbit hole experience, because they're very aggressively trying to unindoctrinate themselves. They're finding all of the ways that they've been lied to over the years about a variety of topics, you know, from food to health to economics to, you know, money, relationships. Like all of these things have been manipulated so that you're a happy, dumb, tax-paying moron. And once you realize that, a lot of us get very, very motivated to pull that stuff apart as fast as possible.
Yeah, it reminds me of when I was a little kid and I realized that Santa Claus wasn't real. And then about 5 minutes later, I walked back into the room where my parents were at and I was like, oh, wait, so like Easter Bunny, Tooth Fairy, like it's all fake, right? You know?
Right.
So it's like once you see one thing, then you can't unsee it, and you start looking in every corner for where these things have been manipulated in your education.
Yeah, totally. I think for a lot of people, the war on drugs has been that, because they've been told, well, you know, if the government is not preventing people from putting certain substances into their bodies, it's just going to be chaos, right? There's going to be drug addicts everywhere. There's going to be all this terrible effects. And then slowly we're seeing things like, I think it was Portugal, they legalized things like heroin, even just hardcore drugs, they legalized them. And it turned out that the opposite was true, right? And I don't know why we're like, we went through prohibition. We went through alcohol prohibition. We know that in the case of alcohol prohibition, it was a terrible thing. But we can look back on those people and think how stupid that was, that they thought they weren't going to create mafias. They were going to have all these negative consequences. And the government itself wasn't going to be in on the action, right? Because the government was. They were taking bribes. They were taking payoffs. They were looking the other way. It was actually a very effective form of human slavery that gets covered in the human threat model called prohibition slavery. You take something that's popular, you make it illegal, and then you're effectively the gatekeeper. You're the only provider of that product, either by looking the other way or actually just flat out being part of the distribution system. You're the only one that doesn't have to worry about getting their front door kicked in. So you're able to really fleece the population. We saw that in the United States through alcohol prohibition. We look back on it and we laugh. But we look at drug prohibition the same way. And the difference is that when we grew up, you know, I'm a Gen Xer, I was not bathed in the propaganda of how evil the world would be without the government breaking all the stills. But I was bathed in the propaganda of how evil the government would be if they didn't, you know, keep everybody from smoking pot or using heroin. And the obvious thing that we start seeing, other than other countries legalizing it and seeing that there's only, you know, positive effects of legalizing these drugs, is that we see that it's still available, right? Like, it's still there. So these narratives, they do eventually break apart. And I think that thanks to the internet, the pace at which these narratives are breaking apart is becoming faster. And I do think that that's going to be a good thing. I think Bitcoin is going to help accelerate that quite a bit, because once you realize that you really don't, like, as a Christian, I'm a Christian, I was taught from a very young age that it's my responsibility to, that when Jesus says, you know, give to Caesar what's Caesar's and give to God what's God's, I was taught from a very young age that meant I was supposed to take a huge portion of my income and give it to the government. And that was a government, whether they were doing evil things, you know, like Caesar and going and killing innocent people. You know, this could be a really, really evil government. And it was still my obligation as a Christian to take a huge portion of my income and support them, right? That sounds insane to me now, but having been bathed in that doctrine from a young age, I believed it was true. But with things like the internet, it's getting harder and harder to maintain those lies. So now any kid that's going, do I really want to pay taxes? They can do a pretty quick search. They can come across the Ethics of Money Production, I think, is Guido Hulsman, that does an excellent job of taking that passage of scripture. I don't even know if the guy's a Christian, but I do know that he's a really strong academic and a strong economist. And he took that passage of scripture and just explained the context of what was going on. And it's mind-boggling. I mean, one of the big red pills of my last decade was going, oh, wow. What's happening there is these people are trying to trick Jesus into saying that it's either moral to pay taxes or it's immoral to pay taxes. Like, that is revolutionary. He was so anti-government that is how they thought that they could trick him, right? Because if he said it was moral to pay taxes to this evil group of people, he was saying it was good to support the local mafia, and that wouldn't have worked. But if he says that it's not, then he'll be executed, right?
Right. So they were trying to turn him over to the Romans. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And what's profound about that is that he doesn't respond and say, oh yeah, it's fine to pay taxes, or it's not, I don't want to talk about that right now. His response is in a way very crafty, the way that he avoids answering the question. And also bigger, right? Like, he had this great way of, you would ask him a small question, he would answer a much bigger question that was more, it was a bigger red pill than you could possibly swallow right now.
Right.
And you know, you don't get mouthy with Jesus, because he'll explain something that you just can't take right now. And that's exactly what he did. He said, give me one of the coins that you're using to pay taxes, you know, that you're using to pay your tithes or whatever in the temple. And he pointed out that this is not allowed under God's law, that this is a coin that says Caesar is Lord, right? And has a picture of Caesar on it. So he indicted their whole monetary system, right? He wasn't just saying, oh, it's okay to pay taxes. He's basically saying, you need to disconnect from this stuff in a much bigger way than you're even asking.
Yeah. And I think,
and
wasn't it
go
like,
go ahead and give that to Caesar, but serve God.
Yeah, I think wasn't he even, it was questionable why they would even have the, like, as
Jews.
Yeah, as Jews, like, why they would even have the Roman money.
Yeah, because the main issue, the main kind of conflict for the Jews was going between worshiping false idols and worshiping God, right? And they were always trying to make these little objects and worship them because they got some spiritual or some satisfaction out of worshiping these things. And the main thing that they weren't supposed to do is create any graven images, right? Like, just don't even create these little false gods in the first place. And there's nothing more blatant than taking the face of a politician, putting it in coinage, and then writing that he's Lord on it, and then carrying that around and using that as the way that you exchange value with people. It was very, very blasphemous and very, couldn't be more directly un-Jewish. But what totally blows my mind now, and this is why I do feel like very much like a deprogrammed cult member, is that that whole exchange that we just talked about is one of the most anti-government, anti-submission to authority things that happens throughout Jesus's life. And they took a couple sentences and they pulled it out of context and they twisted it and they shoved it down my throat when I was too young to push back, right? When I didn't have the intellectual capability to push back. And I've paid a lot of taxes in my life and thought that it was doing the right thing. I still pay taxes now, but there's a big difference. And that is I pay taxes like I'm paying to the mafia,
right?
I pay taxes so that I don't get killed. I pick my battles. I write those checks because I think that I'm better off writing those checks and then working on something like mathbot.com than being in prison. But I'm not, but they don't have my heart anymore, right? My heart's not in it. And you give me an opportunity to check out. If I had a cash only business, you can bet that I probably would pay less taxes.
Right.
Being in software, it's pretty easy to track, but you know, the idea that, that they need us to be, what does the IRS call it? They call it voluntary compliance, I think. I think is the phrase, voluntary compliance. And they talk about how they rely on that quite a bit. In other words, they rely on propaganda.
Yeah.
They have to convince you from your youth that this is the right thing to do and that you're a moral person for supporting wars in Syria, even though you don't support the war, right? Like, these wars have been wildly unpopular, but you have people that hated Vietnam, but still felt like they were obligated to pay for the bombs. You can only really do that if you have a really excellent propaganda machine. And I think that Internet, like, as much as people hate Twitter right now and they're mad at Facebook for the censorship, like, look, we have way more people broadcasting content than we did 30 years ago before the internet. Before the internet, the best that we could do was have some hippie in a van driving around doing pirate radio. Now everybody is able to put their content up, and yes, it gets pulled down, and yes, it's not ideal, but the amount of power that the individual has now is far greater than the amount of power the individual had 30 years ago. And that terrifies the establishment that wants to continue to fleece you and continue to deceive you. And so they're doing their best to kind of clamp down, but it's not working, right? It's a very pathetic shadow of the monopoly of communication that they had 30 years ago, even with all of the censorship. And so they're taking actually a lot less of our freedom than they did 30 years ago, and we're more pissed off about it. So that's a very good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, we're definitely moving in the right direction. So let me ask you this: why you said you charged for your in-person class? Why are you giving away 10 hours of Bitcoin for free?
Well, to be honest, the initial idea was I was going to give it away for free, but I wanted to make sure that it was actually going to work. I threw up some YouTube videos that discussed some of this content, and I could tell that it wasn't totally clicking with people. So I thought, all right, I'm going to have to walk people through it basically in person. So the $300 version, you just spend a whole day with me. You'd basically watch the videos and then do a Q&A with me. And then I had a couple of guest Q&A people come in, and it was fun, but it really, the downside of that approach, and I do think that there were some people that were really impacted by it, some people that are going to have influence in the community going forward. So I think it was a good effort, but the downside with that approach is that it just doesn't scale very well. So it's been sort of an experiment back and forth, like how much hands-on manual work am I going to put into it to create the best possible experience versus how much can I scale it? We put 50 or 60 people through that, and I'm happy with it, but we really need to get 500, 5,000. Like when there's the next bull run and there's 60,000 new people that are interested in Bitcoin, I want there to be a place that's trustworthy, that is succinct, and that's well organized, that people can send them. And I think 10hoursofbitcoin.com is it. And if it's not, then we just need to change some stuff on it, right? I think the concept overall is, let's not ask people to put in less than 10 hours, and let's not ask them to put in more than 10 hours. Let's assume that somebody is going to give us 10 hours and make sure that they have the very best stuff available. And even my stuff, right? I'm hoping that somebody's going to do something better, cover the basics of economics better than I did, maybe with more more production value. There's a lot of ways that it could be improved. And as soon as that happens, like my stuff will be brutally torn down just as fast as anybody else's. So the idea is that we really need, we need it to scale. If I was just doing these classes and we have 60,000 people that show up brand new to Bitcoin in a month and during the next bull run, and I get 60 of them through the course material, it's just, it doesn't work as well.
Yeah. Gotcha. I don't really believe in coincidence, but I think it was excellent timing that, that you and I kind of connected on this, 'cause I was getting ready to go back and do kind of a series of basic episodes of, you know, that I could reference back to for when people come and listen to episodes that are maybe a little more technical or a little more current eventy, and say, hey, you know, go back and listen to episodes blank through blank to kind of get your basics. So it was kind of really good timing that you reached out and I found your 10 hours of Bitcoin and go through this, because I think this can serve like, hey, go back to this episode, go through the 10 hours of Bitcoin and then come back.
Yeah. Yeah. Good deal, man. I'm really glad we connected as well. The context of this conversation is kind of interesting. We were talking a little bit about this before the show, but I launched 10 hours of Bitcoin, I don't know, 2 weeks ago. And when I launched it, it was on the What Bitcoin Did podcast. So we talked through it. I basically made a case for Bitcoin maximalism that I think is a pretty strong case, and said, look, go out to 10hoursofbitcoin.com, go through the material, and then let's have a discussion. Once you have the foundation, at least you know exactly where I'm coming from. Most of the content isn't mine anyways. It's, you know, guys like Nick Szabo and Saifedean and Elizabeth Stark. But then you'll have the right foundation. If you want to be a fan of these other cryptocurrencies, at least you'll know the argument against them very clearly. And that's a good thing for any investor, to know the argument against why their product or service is something that should be desired. And what's funny is that episode, I think, was pretty popular. I think it did well. It got a lot of attention. It was pretty controversial. But immediately, Saifedean Solid, Andreas Antonopoulos, went on the Stefan Levera podcast. And it was basically an argument against maximalism, and kind of a frustrating one to listen to be honest, because Stefan Levera took a very milquetoast position right off the bat of, you know, Bitcoin maximalism being like 80% market share, which that was the first time I'd ever heard anybody be that weak and sort of pacifying, while at the same time saying they were a Bitcoin maximalist. And I like Stefan Levera a lot. He has one of the best podcasts in the space for sure, like definitely in the top three. And I think he's got, in general, a pretty good grasp of economics. But that was a frustrating conversation. And then immediately after that, Andreas, who has not done a lot of podcasts, certainly he's never done these two, you know, very Bitcoin maximalist podcasts ever before. He showed up to What Bitcoin Did podcast, I think just this last week, and, you know, 40 minutes, or, you know, basically the whole discussion was an argument against maximalism. Very weak, very tricky arguments, not sound, very much just rhetoric and sort of gameplay sort of arguments that academics like to play, but are pretty easy to see through if you just hit pause periodically and go, well, what did he just say? What exactly is he arguing for here? So I'm glad that I'm able to come on here and continue to get the word out that that Bitcoin maximalism is not crazy. It's just a clear understanding of the technology and the economics involved. And that if you really want to hear the argument, right, don't hear the argument for Bitcoin maximalism from some guy that is very much financially incentivized for you not to get it and for him not to get it. You know, the guy that wrote the Ethereum book, among other very questionable things. Get it from 10hoursofbitcoin.com. Go through that and you'll have a really solid understanding of the argument, even if you don't buy it, right? You don't want to hear the argument for something from its detractors.
So let me ask this. I have not listened to either of those episodes yet that Andreas was on. So I don't know what arguments he made. Do you feel like, well, one, do you feel like his book, Mastering Bitcoin, is still... technically worthwhile?
No, I don't.
Really?
No, absolutely not. And the reason that I say that is that that saying something like mastering Bitcoin is fine, because Bitcoin is a legitimate technology, right? Like, you could say mastering blood tests, right? And that could be all about how you draw blood and the different kind of technologies that we have available to test blood and figure out, you know, whether your white blood cell count is too high, too low, or whatever. That would be legitimate. But if somebody wrote a book called Mastering Theranos right now, and Theranos is this scam company out of Silicon Valley where they pretended they had blood testing, and billions of dollars were involved. The Secretary of State was one of the folks that funded it. The people that invested in Theranos is absolutely a who's who list of the supposedly smartest people around. And from day one, this 19-year-old girl, she was 19 when she started it. She dropped out of Stanford, so she's checking all the right boxes. She changes her voice, right? She's like the Vitalik of this medical testing thing. Like, she talks with a deep voice. She's this like cute little 19-year-old blonde girl, but she changes her voice to sound really deep and tough because it appeals to these weird people that that are investors in Silicon Valley. San Francisco is a weird place, and so something like that can help you raise money. And she did it really, really well. She was a very good con artist. She appealed to the right sort of non-gendering things that people wanted to hear. She was on the cover of Time magazine as the next Steve Jobs, right? Yeah. So she was very good at PR. She was very effective, and she was a fraudster and a liar from the beginning. She never had the ability to do blood tests. Never once. It was always a lie. And now that's clear, but that took a long time. I think that company was founded in 2001, 2002, something. I mean, she's not 19 anymore. She's in her 30s. And she's only now negotiating prison time, right? So when you look at something like Ethereum, you can say, oh, it's not scammy. Like, the SEC has said it's not a security. No, they haven't. You're being very generous with your interpretation. Just because somebody is not in prison right now means nothing. Nobody goes to prison for Ponzi schemes in the United States in less than 5, 6, 7 years. And that's basically because you have to wait for the Ponzi scheme to implode. You have to wait for people to shake off all the propaganda and all the hopes and dreams that they had. And people don't do that until it goes to zero. And then they get pissed off, and then they start filing things with the SEC. That cycle is still on track for Ethereum. There's no reason to believe that's behind schedule, right? It's not behind schedule. Now, I don't know if it's going to happen or not, but there's no reason to believe that it won't based on the fact that it hasn't happened yet, because it's not late. And what I can tell you for sure is that Ethereum has nothing to offer. It has no technology. There's nothing actually worthwhile happening there. There never was. And everybody knows it, right? All the technically competent security people, they know it. Things like the DAO revealed it to the non-technical people, right? What's the point of a blockchain? Well, it's to create a list of transactions that are resistant to government intervention. Even the most powerful governments in the world would not be able to effectively attack this ordering of transactions. That's the point of a blockchain. What happened with the DAO? There were some transactions that Vitalik didn't like. What was the solution? Those transactions went away. You don't have to be a security genius to understand. It's a very short circle of logic that you have to be able to follow to realize that Ethereum is a fraud and a scam. And they've done a very good job appealing to the same people that the Theranos guys appealed to, right? They've done all the social justice things just right. They've had the right unicorns and the right rainbows and the right dance parties. But that doesn't mean that it's not on track to fail. And when somebody writes a book called Mastering Ethereum, they're deceiving the public. They're part of the machine that is putting out misinformation about the quality of this blockchain.
Yeah. So what about his first book, the one about Bitcoin?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some value in that book. I don't have anything really bad to say about his book there. Yeah, so he's never really been strong on the economic side, and that's really important to understand, because the economics incentives are what keeps the blockchain secure, right? And I think that I think it's really important to understand that. So I would recommend people start more on the economic side. Like if somebody's new and they're looking for a book, I'd say read the Bitcoin Standard first, read Human Action. If you are technical and you really want to understand what's going on, I would say, you know, it's not a bad place to go, but probably don't look to it too strongly for the economic insights that actually keep the blockchain secure.
Gotcha. So what would you say? I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a second. You know, this Bitcoin maximalism thing, you know, people might accuse you or accuse maximalists in general of being anti-competition of monies. What's your response to that?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that Andreas will say. The other things that he'll say, just to throw it out here real quick, one is that like it's a fear response, right? We're maximalist because the market is down, but when everybody's happy and money is flowing, then we'll be really excited about other monies, you know, a multiple money world. So the other argument that he makes, like the two arguments that he makes that are the most painful and the most directly at the heart of Bitcoin and this mission to create a secure money, is one that competing currencies will always exist. That very much undermines the value proposition for investors, right? If you think that money is going to be like the US dollar, but it's going to be global, it makes a lot of sense to gamble a certain amount, right? To risk a certain amount, to speculate on which currency is going to be adopted. Just like if you were looking at different startups and there was a startup that had the potential to, you know, have 100% market share because it's like a protocol or a language or something like that, it makes it more attractive to invest in it if that's the world and that's how the world works. So that idea that we're always going to have multiple monies very much undermines the value proposition of Bitcoin. And it's really just a misunderstanding of economics. The other big argument that he makes is that Bitcoin is not going to change human nature. And that's really unfortunate because nobody's suggesting that it is, of course. And that's one of those, you know, tricks that academics and liars use. They straw man you, right? Nobody that's excited about the societal impact of a secure and sound money is excited because we think it's going to change human nature. We're excited because we think it could make it a lot more expensive to fleece people and steal from them in a systematic way, which is also known as slavery. And if slavery becomes unprofitable, it will end, just like the particular form of chattel slavery that we had, racial slavery, ended after the Industrial Revolution, because unskilled labor that you can get by beating somebody on the back with a stick, the value of that dropped so much that it became unprofitable, so it went away. So the hope is not that we're going to change human nature. The hope is that we're going to change the technology, right? We're going to change the environment to where it's no longer profitable to commit these certain set of acts of evil, and therefore that certain set of acts of evil will go away. So it's not a crazy belief. It's not a religious belief. It's an understanding of how history works and how technology can make the world better in limited but very far-reaching and profound ways.
Gotcha. So you think, now I'm curious about this because you're saying it's going to go all to one, and I'm not saying that I necessarily think there's going to be successful or good monies, multiple good monies, because I don't really see any value proposition in any altcoin. But I would be surprised if there wasn't continued, maybe not the same ones, but more other coins trying to, if you've read Michael Goldstein's article, Everyone's a Scammer, right? Like other things that pop up and try and get you to put your Bitcoin into them. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
the way I'm wording that?
Yeah, totally. So the Bitcoin maximalist position, and actually a great document to look at to understand the position if you don't want to go through 10 hours of Bitcoin and you just want sort of the very high level bullet points. If you search for Bitcoin Maximalist Manifesto, it's a one-page doc, and it basically is divided into economic understanding and technical understanding. And if you go through these bullet points, you'll be able to at least identify where you disagree, or where you think that maybe, you know, maybe if you agreed with this, you would be a maximalist. One of the main problems with the idea of competing currencies is that you're not understanding the role that money plays. So if you understand what barter is, and again, 10 hours of Bitcoin.com is going to do a much better job making this argument than I can do in short order. But I'll give it my best. If you understand how barter works, barter is basically you and I show up together and we want to trade stuff. And if I have stuff that you want and you have stuff that I want, that's a great circumstance, but it doesn't happen very often, right? The chances that if you're out looking for a bow and arrow and I'm out looking for chickens and you happen to be carrying around chickens and I've got a bow and arrow and I'm willing to part with my stuff and you're willing to part with your stuff, and it works out in the right proportions and the right ratios all at once, this all happens at this one moment in time, there's a lot of reasons that that wouldn't line up, right? So that's unfortunate because anytime humans trade voluntarily and there's no fraud and deceit involved, both people are more wealthy after it's over. If I'm willing to give you five chickens for your bow and arrow, that means that I think that if I had your bow and arrow, I would be more wealthy. I'd be more able to control the environment around me, provide for myself and my family, make the world more delightful with a bow and arrow than with five chickens. And if you think that you're better off with those five chickens than with the bow and arrow, maybe because you make bow and arrows and you have a bunch of, your tribe is really good at that, but you don't have any chickens yet, right? In that circumstance, the only way that the trade actually happens is when both people are more wealthy. That's extremely valuable. It allows humans to cooperate and make the world better without having to kill, right? I can be better off without killing you, and overall, everybody's better off. That's a magical way for us to cooperate. So we want that to happen as much as possible, but it doesn't happen that much because the coincidence of wants, everything lining up just right, isn't going to happen as often as it could. So the solution to that is this third thing that we've called money. But really what it is it's another object that we can use, another asset that we can use to facilitate trade. And nobody can order a group of people to do it. They can order a group of people to change their behaviors in ways that makes a particular asset more attractive than others, which is what we have with the US dollar, but that's another story. But the third object is something that that is so often wanted that if I bring it with me, I'm pretty sure that if I bring, you know, some wampum, if I bring these seashells with me as I go to meet other people, as I'm trying to buy a bow and arrow, if I find anybody that just has a bow and arrow that they're willing to part with, I'm going to be able to make that trade because everybody accepts wampum, right? It's very commonly accepted. And part of the reason that it becomes very commonly accepted is that it's so useful to have something that's commonly accepted because other people will want it, that a community of people, when they trade together a lot, and we see this in all different cultures, Nick Szabo's essay on 10 hours of Bitcoin.com covers this in a really great way. They realize that there is something in the environment that works better as money than anything else. And it has certain attributes. It's like, it's easy to divide. It's easy to verify. You can use it for small purchases or large purchases, right? It's whatever the thing is that works best. At different times, it has been animal pelts. It's been seashells. It's been gold. It's been silver, right? It's been really, really big rocks. And it's always the thing that group of people have settled on. And they're actually pretty good at it, right? Like, we don't see a lot of examples of civilizations settling on something like wampum when something better was available. We have a lot of reason to believe that they actually do a pretty good job at picking the thing that's available that works best. But even as I explain that, that story required that I reference the thing, right? Like, we're talking about an asset that's going to fill this particular role that we refer to as money, that economists call a store of value, a medium of exchange, and a unit of account. And it creates all of these great opportunities when we have that. It just doesn't make trade happen more often. It also allows us to do something that can only happen if it's one thing, and that is do profit calculation. If everybody is using the same thing, like gold ounces, then I can say at the end of the year that I have more money, more wealth than I had at the beginning of the year. Because at the beginning of the year, maybe I had five goats, three chickens and two dogs. And at the end of the year, I have 15 horses. How do I know whether I'm better off with 15 horses than that combination of things that I had before? The only real way to do that is to have a third item that I can measure everything by, and that is so popular that I'm confident that in when things are priced in that thing, right? So if the third item was like cows, right? Cows are the best that we have available. But we haven't really settled on it yet, right? Like some people tend to use goats. Other people tend to use cows. When I'm trying to do my profit calculation, I have a lot less confidence in the price ratios, right? How much is a horse? Well, I think it's about this number of cows, but these guys use goats. And so now I've got to try to figure out, do I trust the price in goats more, or do I trust the price in cows more? There's all kinds of problems that having money, which is a unit of account, and that's why economists call it a unit of account, that there's a lot of problems that solves. And humans don't have to understand all the reasons that something is better. They can choose something because it's better for them in some small niche area. Other people can choose it because they're doing profit calculation. But we know from history, and we know from the way that people tend to work, that if something works better than something else, they'll use it. And a lot of the reasons that something works better is because everybody else is using it. So it creates this very virtuous cycle where you do tend to very rapidly coalesce on just one item so that you can get all of these great benefits from it. So when you say, why wouldn't we live in a world where there's multiple or competing monies? Of course, we're going to live in a world where there's competing monies. As soon as somebody invents something better than Bitcoin, it's going to compete with Bitcoin. It's going to replace it and dominate it. But if you say, why don't we live in a world with multiple monies? That's saying, like, why don't we live in a world with multiple hydrogens? No, hydrogen is a word that describes this particular element. Money is a word that describes this particular tool. And that tool has to be universal amongst a group of people that trade together, or it's just not that tool.
All right. Does that make sense? Yeah. No, I just sit and processing for a second. No, that's good.
It's tough, man. I'm doing my best to take.
I'm asking. I could go on about this for a while with you, but I think that we'd be doing a disservice to 10 hours of Bitcoin, because then, you know,
I'm happy
that- in the video series. So I think everyone should just go and listen to it. But
I do a better job of making the argument and being very slow and systematic and building up to it basics on 10 hours of Bitcoin.com. But hopefully that's helpful. Yeah. I guess the overall thing that I want people to understand is that, unlike what Andreas is trying to put out there, and the reason that I harp on Andreas is he represents like 90% of the Bitcoin community at this point. He's by far and away the most popular Bitcoin personality around. And the ideas that he's pushing are really, really insidious. And this idea that we're going to have multiple monies forever is false. But if you ask yourself the classic question of who benefits, the answer is really obvious, right? Who benefits from this idea that that there's going to be multiple monies in the future? Like, we don't see multiple monies in the United States. We do see multiple monies globally, but we know that that's because of government intervention, right? They prevent people from being able to use the money that they want across borders, right? If you're in Canada, you're not allowed to use the US dollar for money. You have to use the Canadian dollar. The whole point of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies is to break the government monopoly, right? To create a form of money that governments can't manipulate and control and steal from. So now we have a world where there isn't any national borders that are effective. Because if they're effective, then we're back to fiat money, right? If the government is going to be able to force you to use their currency and you're in Mbokbok, then you're using Mbokbok coins, and it doesn't matter. But if cryptocurrencies actually can deliver on the promise, and I think we've seen that Bitcoin can deliver on the promise because it is, people are able to choose it even if they happen to be in a jurisdiction where Mbokbok coin is required, or the US dollar is required. So that gets rid of the whole argument for monies ending at national borders. Now we're in a world where monies compete And we've seen a world like that before. We're not, this is not sci-fi here. Like, it wasn't that long ago that gold was used as money globally. So, and the reason that it was used is because we have a global trading environment, right? Like, our tribe is global now. I buy shoes from China. I sell software to New Zealand, right? There's a very, very dynamic environment of trade that goes from one end of the globe all the way to the other. So we would expect that we would have a single global money as soon as those acts of government intervention are circumvented. And that's what we're trying to do. So that is, it's very reasonable to think that that's what we're going to end up with.
Yeah, very cool. If you've been listening to the show recently, you'll know I launched BitcoinMeritBadge.com, an online store where you can buy Velcro-backed patches to celebrate accomplishments and culture in Bitcoin. It's a great way to support my work and show off your love for Bitcoin at the same time. But what you might not know is that my manufacturer, Patcheon, is also a Bitcoin-friendly business. Patcheon has been accepting Bitcoin since 2011 and accepts on-chain and Lightning Network Bitcoin, as well as a handful of other cryptocurrency payments. Patcheon will work with you to build custom embroidered patches to fit your need, including various backings like adhesive and Velcro. There's no minimum order, so whether you want a big patch or a small patch, one or a thousand, Patcheon is your stop for custom embroidered patches. Check them out today at patcheon.uk. Okay, let's transition. I think we've gone through that pretty well, and I want to give you a chance to talk about MathBot, because I think that's the first place that I heard about you, actually. May have been on Tom Woods on that episode you talked about. So go ahead and kind of give us an overview real quick of what MathBot is and why you created it.
Yeah. So when I originally created it, it was before I was into Bitcoin, but I'll tell you the reasons that I brought it back to life, because I had basically shelved it when I decided to do the Bitcoin threat model and get into Bitcoin. And I picked it back up about a year ago, maybe 9 months ago. And the reason that I did is I realized that if Bitcoin is successful, the best place to build the business is going to be in a business that is going to be disrupted by Bitcoin, right? If you are if you're right at the verge of the internet, and you're looking at what businesses are going to be disrupted by the internet, one of the best ones to go into is book sales, right? Because books are they're easy to ship. You don't have to try them on, right? Like, you know what you're getting. They're basically commodities, and you can build a pretty simple website and people can pick their book and it gets shipped out. With Bitcoin, it's going to disrupt a lot of things that exist right now too. And I think anything that is highly dependent on taxation is going to have a really, really hard time. Even if you don't buy a lot of my arguments, around global money and economics. Again, go out to 10hoursofbitcoin.com and go through that content before you hit me up on Twitter and tell me why I'm wrong. But if you don't buy all that, just understand these really simple things. Cash businesses in the United States pay almost no tax. You can verify this by just doing a search on IRS war on cash. And the justification that the IRS has for, for example, we only have $100 bills now. $100 bills are basically worth what $20 bills used to be worth. We're not printing $1,000 bills. We really should probably have $10,000 bills at this point after inflation, and we should have gotten rid of the penny and probably the dime a long time ago. But the reason they don't want to do that is there is a war on cash. And one of the main reasons there's a war on cash is not terrorism. It's because it's extremely hard to tax a cash-only business. If you go buy fruits from somebody on the highway and you give them 20 bucks and you walk off with some oranges, the IRS has a really hard time getting their cut of that 20 bucks. They're very open about it at this point. They're not going to get their cut, right? So they don't like cash. But Bitcoin is electronic cash. Bitcoin is cash that allows for private transactions as well, that functions as cash, but it has all the advantages of an electronic payment. So now imagine that I go up to the roadside stand and I scan a QR code and I pay for the oranges and I walk off. Even less likely that that guy is going to end up paying taxes, because he's not going to take that $20. He's not going to take a stack of money and deposit it into a bank every night where it gets tracked and coded and referenced, right, for the IRS to say, hey, he was making these deposits. He's just going to keep it in a Bitcoin wallet and then he's going to spend it, right? Maybe he'll end up buying something online with it. And you take that same scenario, and because it's electronic, it applies to lots of stuff, right? Like you can buy books now with Bitcoin. You can buy a lot of things with Bitcoin. If your landlord has any idea what he's doing, he'll let you pay rent with Bitcoin, right? So Bitcoin is taking cash and combining it with electronic payments, and that is an absolute nightmare for the IRS. So what that means is, and it's not a stretch to understand this, is that as we adopt electronic cash like Bitcoin, we're going to see a lot less taxes paid. So one of the implications of that is that the public school system is going to be defunded, right? It's going to see, it's already terrible, right? Funding has gone up on the public school system. They have more money, they have more vacation, they have more power and prestige, especially through the teachers' unions, than they've ever had. Test scores go down so bad that every few years we have to rewrite the scoring system of the SATs so that kids don't feel stupid when they realize how much poorer they scored than their parents, right? The college admission system, they could just adjust the SAT scores, but they don't want to do that. And they don't want everybody to realize how ineffective they are. So they just go cook the books. And if you get, you know, a much lower score than your dad did, it looks like you scored as well as him or better. That's the current public school system. And they're awash in funding, right? These guys are getting money thrown at them like crazy. Class sizes are small. Teachers have a lot of time off. Now take that and imagine what's going to happen if Bitcoin is actually successful. We're going to see less funding. And this system is already terrible. So that means to somebody like me that's an entrepreneur, there's a lot of opportunity to compete anywhere that the government is currently providing a service, because they're going to not be able to be as good at it, and they already are terrible at it. So that's, I would say that's a good way to understand my motivation for creating mathbot.com, because our mission is to teach math and programming to kids and encourage people to homeschool and basically compete with government regulated schools and get math and programming as far away from government hands as possible.
Awesome. So for anybody who hasn't been to mathbot.com, I mean, it's basically like, I kind of share my experience and you tell me if I'm missing something here. You get on, you maybe create an account, and it's this little robot, and you start, giving him directions to get him to achieve, you know, move across these little squares. And by doing that, you're progressing through these different stages of mathematical learning, from counting. And then you get into, step counting and things like that. And you're going through, different ways of learning math and, understanding these concepts in a very fun way.
Yeah. So if you go out to mathbot.com, you don't have to pay anything. You can sign up and you can immediately start programming a robot to, first he's just moving and then he's walking through mazes. But pretty soon he's picking up objects that have either the number 1 or 10 or 100 or 1,000 on them. And he's using those objects to solve math problems. So right now, if you play the game, there's about 200 levels. And the very first level, all you do is walk forward once. But you are actually programming the robot. So you're programming, you're learning programming, but then you're learning enough programming to where you can solve math problems using programming. That's a very fun way to get a good mastery of both. And right now, there's about 200 levels that will take you through solving the cube root problems, right? So you do square root of 4 is 2. You can program the robot to solve that problem. We go up to cube root. Our plan is to continue to add more and more levels until we've gone all the way through calculus, and then continue on with really interesting math problems, fun puzzle math problems, you know, golden ratio stuff, anything that you've ever heard of that you're like, oh, that's interesting. That's what math is about, right? It's about problem solving and using logic and reason. It's puzzles. We're hardwired as humans to enjoy it. The only reason people think that they don't like math, or they might not like programming because they don't like math, is that they never got to experience math. They got to experience the DMV version of math, right? Yeah. If drawing, right, like learning how to draw a cylinder or playing around with a pen and paper and kind of exploring what things that you can recreate with that, you know, learning how to draw a leaf, if that's math, filling out forms for the DMV is actually what you got experienced, right? You didn't experience math. You experienced the DMV form of art, yeah, right? Or of drawing.
Real quick for our international listeners, the DMV is the Department of Motor Vehicles, and it's this like soul-sucking line world where nobody has a smile on their face, and it's a pretty torturous experience to get your driver's license in the US, among other things. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the government is not good at providing services. They don't have competition that encourages them to do better. They don't have investors that want customers to be so happy they're willing to pay more. It's socialism at work. We know socialism doesn't produce good outcomes, but we still experience socialism when it comes to the school system in the United States. We're all forced to pay in. The government selects the employees. You don't have a choice. You can opt out, but you're still paying for it. So it's created this really, really miserable environment where even something as fun as problem solving using logic and reason, something that from before Christ all the way through Einstein, people experienced this through Euclid's Elements, which was a book probably originally written by Euclid or somebody that may have been his contemporary, but was evolved over the years. This is how most people all through, like literally from before Christ, like Alexander the Great, all the way through Albert Einstein, they all learned math through Euclid's Elements. And it's a delight. It's really fun. You get problems like, how do you create a triangle with three sides that are all equal if all you can do is draw a straight line and use a compass? That's interesting, right? Like, it'd be fun to just sit around and screw around and play around with that, draw some circles, see if you can figure it out, maybe get a few hints thrown at you when you get stuck. That's designed to be enjoyable for humans, and it causes you to learn and understand the world around you more. And kids love that, right? We all love to understand the world around us and how it fits together more. We're hardwired chemically to enjoy that. But all of that sounds very foreign to anybody that's been through the public school system in the United States in particular, but the whole world has been following the United States lead on this. The way that the government is going to teach you math is that even if they did take Euclid's Elements as a textbook, this is how they would do it. They wouldn't say, hey, we want you to draw a triangle with three sides. Here's some tools. Play around, figure it out. I'll throw you a hint if you get, you know, before you get frustrated. That's how good teachers do it. The way that the government teaches math, if they were to teach that, is they would say, let me explain a process and a procedure to you. You're going to draw a line. On each end of each line, you're going to draw a circle. Where those circles intersect, you're going to draw a dot. Then you're going to draw a dot from, or you're going to draw a line from dot A to dot B, and then you're going to draw a line from dot A to dot C. That's how you do it. And then they would make you do that about 150 times and probably add some really annoying steps to that process. So the way that you know that you're actually experiencing math is if you're enjoying the problem-solving process. If you're presented with a problem and you're given some tools and you get to solve it like a puzzle, if it feels kind of like a game, that's a hint that you might actually be doing math. If you're following a set of operations, then you're not experiencing math. You're just filling out a form for the DMV, and you're just doing it again and again and again, and it's meaningless and it's soul sucking, and you don't actually feel like you've learned anything when it's over.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that about the hints. I was gonna say, because I went a couple months back through a chunk of MathBot just to play around with it. And there was a part where I got to and I was like, how do I do this? And I got really frustrated. And I guess, I don't know why, I was, something in my browser settings was blocking the little ability for the hint videos. And so I put it down for a while. And then I came back to it, I guess, in a different browser. And I found the, you've got hint videos on there. And it is, it's really cool because you pull it up and you don't give the answer away, but you give just enough that the user can figure out the answer. And it does, it gives you that feeling like I've accomplished something.
Yeah, totally. It's definitely been a work in progress. So I think when I was on the Tom Wood show, we may not have even had the hints yet. We had it on the roadmap. It was part of the plan, but we had only been seriously working hard on it, I think, for 6 months at that point. So, but at this point, the way that the incentive structure works in MathBot is everybody can play for free. You can play all of the levels. We're never going to change that, but if you get stuck, there is a button that you can click and you get a little hint video. If you pass the level without any hints, you get 3 stars. If you pass the level with 1 hint, you get 2 stars. So basically you trade a star for a hint. But as soon as you use a hint, there's a timer that runs. And if you use a hint and then come back to that level 60 minutes later, you can pass it again and get all 3 stars. So you don't have to feel like, oh, I shouldn't use a hint. Just use the hints, have a good time, learn the content, and then come back and show that you've mastered it without any hints by getting all 3 stars. What we're adding soon, which I'm super excited about, we actually just finished the payment server today.
Oh, nice.
And it's an interface between OpenNode and MathBot. We're building a separate payment server because we want it to be relatively secure and isolate our code, like good software developers should. But what's going to happen soon is when you pass a level with all 3 stars, you're going to get about 20 cents worth of Bitcoin is what you'll earn. So the idea is after you pass these, 200 levels, you'll earn about, I think it's $40 worth of Bitcoin. And that will encourage the kids to keep going. It's a really bad idea to ask people to do stuff and not have some kind of reward system built in. If you have your kid and you tell them to take out the trash, it's probably a good idea to buy them an ice cream if they're responsible and they take out the trash every day for 5 days in a row, right? It's human nature to appreciate rewards and incentives. It's a good thing. This is another thing that public school systems will tell you is a bad thing, because they've done studies and they've found that if they give $5 or $10 to inner city kids for every A that they get, that test scores go dramatically up. But they don't want that to be true because it really exposes just how corrupt and stupid their system is. So they have they've convinced most of the United States. This is a great just to take it full circle back to the propaganda machine and how we're all constantly having to fight these lies that we're indoctrinated with. Because they don't want to expose the corruption of their own system, they have they've basically put on a good campaign in the United States, like a very effective marketing campaign, to convince parents that if they reward their kids financially for learning, that they will remove the love of learning. If you can imagine, I mean, it's insanity, but I'm sure that there's some listeners right now that are like, oh, well, wait a minute. If I give my kid $5 for every A he gets, then he's not going to be learning algebra for the pure joy of it. That's not how we work. Like, we don't, how many programmers would we have right now solving really hard problems, probably trying to build a pacemaker that's going to keep your old butt alive in 20 or 30 years? How many of those people are going to do that if you don't reward them, right? If you don't at least say good job, but maybe good job and throw them an ice cream, right? Maybe good job and $20 of Bitcoin so they can buy that game that they're looking forward to. Like, it's absolutely insane that we've convinced parents in this country that that's a bad idea, but in MathBot, the system will reward kids 20 cents for every level that they master as they learn math and programming.
Very cool. Where is that coming from, you guys, the creators of MathBot?
No. There's basically like a sort of a crowdfunding site element to it. So the way that the workflow that we've designed, and we haven't released it yet, so it may change and we need to experiment with it. But the basic idea is, let's say Billy sits down and he starts playing levels and he's mastering math and programming. He'll see that he's earning money. And when it says that he's got $1.20 or $2.50, when he clicks on that, it'll take him to a page that he can share with his parents that's basically a sponsor me page that says, hey, you know, if you spend $20, then or if you spend $22, then 20 of those dollars will be passed along to little Billy as he passes levels, and this will encourage him to master programming up through recursive functions or whatever he's working towards. It's going to be an interesting friction point. The way that we're thinking about it right now is we'll encourage parents to just use the Cash App to buy, you know, $50 or $100 worth of Bitcoin and then send us a little bit through the sponsor Billy page so that we can pass on the rewards to Billy.
Yeah, and then that way you guys don't have to do any of the money exchanging either, which makes it simpler.
Yeah, we don't want to be a Bitcoin exchange if we can avoid it. And I don't know of anything. I mean, the downside of the Cash App is that it is KYC. Right, right. It has, you know, centralized, it's all that sort of stuff. But when you're talking about just trying to get $100 or $200 worth of Bitcoin over the course of a few years to reward your kid for learning programming, it's probably not worth, you know, meeting some dude through local Bitcoins.
Yeah. Here's 10 hours of Bitcoin.com. Go through that. Now go learn about Wasabi Wallet and mix your coins. And then, yeah.
Right. Yep. Totally. I am excited about a few things with making it easier to buy and sell Bitcoin that I think are coming down the horizon, though. I think the guys at Liquid or the guys at Blockstream are doing a really good job with Liquid. It's really exciting that there's going to be a Japanese yen-backed stablecoin on Liquid that you're going to be able to swap in and out of Bitcoin. I think that's going to be a really great on-ramp. So I'm looking forward to things getting easier there, but that's not going to be our focus.
Yeah, very cool. Real quick, this is just a fun question. Why Chewbacca?
Oh man, that is funny. You know, I think I always, had it like, I'm in my mid-40s, right? So Star Wars was a big part of my childhood. And, I always liked Chewbacca as a character. I always thought he was an interesting dude, and you don't have a whole lot of his backstory. So part of why I like Chewbacca is that I made up my own backstory for him. At this point, his backstory involves Yoda being Satoshi, the two of them flying too close to a star and ending up in our solar system. My kids think it's pretty fun. It sounds probably very insane, but actually the normal story of Chewbacca, from what I've pieced together, I was never into Star Wars enough to actually like read the novels and that sort of stuff, but he just seems like a dude that just wants to hang out in the woods with his kids, and the evil empire is screwing with him. So he's going to go tear stuff up that needs to be torn up and get back to that as soon as he can.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you see Solo?
I did. Yeah. I've pretty much sworn off all the new Star Wars movies. Although I have a solution that I'm really excited about. I just don't, I decided I don't have the guts to do it myself. I think that I've probably been, a little too active online, to take on this particular project. But if anybody's listening, I'm really looking forward to donating small amounts of Bitcoin to people that have posted edited versions of Star Wars and other great stories online. I think that's a really interesting business model. Right now, it's really easy to use Kodi to watch content on Tor. I think the problem that we have right now that needs to be solved is a rating system for publishers so that I can go, all right, show me publishers that only have 5-star content. Because I would like to be able to watch stuff like Star Wars without the, you know, without having to find out that the Millennium Falcon was really some transsexual weird robot that had their soul inserted in my childhood toys. That would be great. Like if somebody could just edit that garbage out and I could enjoy Star Wars with my kids, right. That would be awesome.
Yeah, agreed. Cool. All right, man. How can we keep up with your work?
10hoursofbitcoin.com is definitely the place to go for all the Bitcoin content. If you have any interest in mathbot.com or you think somebody that might be, definitely send them there. And then I'm also on Twitter. You can hit me up at JWWeatherman_. Always happy to have feedback on both of those websites, 10hoursofbitcoin.com or mathbot.com. There's a lot of work going into Mathbot right now. And if you run into a bug, or if you checked it out in the past and couldn't quite get it, you know, maybe it was before we had hints, try it again, and then hit me up and let me know if it's going well or not. It's very, very much appreciated.
All right. Very cool. Well, JW, this has been a lot of fun. I appreciate you coming on, and take care.
Yeah, man. Yeah, it was great. Thanks.
All right, guys, that's the end of our show for today. I hope you enjoyed it. I had a lot of fun doing that interview. So y'all go check out 10hoursofbitcoin.com. Even if you've been in the space for a while, I think it's maybe a good refresher. Just kind of look through and see if there's any of those things that you haven't listen to, or maybe listen to them again or watch them again. Pretty good stuff. And then if you have suggestions for things that could make it better, like he said, let him know online, on Twitter. I'll include links to all the stuff in the show notes. Go check out mathbot.com. It's a lot of fun, you know. You know, for adults, you breeze through the lower levels pretty quickly. But it's a good way to familiarize yourself with it, and then be able to, if you either you got kids or you know somebody that's got kids, and be able to kind of show them. So I really think it's a cool project. And then I know this has kind of been a longer episode, so I'm going to kind of go through this quickly. The show notes will have obviously links to those, as well as JW's Twitter, and then a lot of the stuff, some of the videos and books that we talked about in this episode. I've also got a link to a paper that's about the whole biblical interaction between Jesus and the Pharisees, and rethinking the whole the common interpretation of render unto Caesar. So that kind of breaks it down in a really good way and gives cultural context and a more detailed explanation of some of that stuff that we talked about. It's a really good read. You should check that out. Yeah, you guys know how to support the show, like and subscribe, and share it with everybody you know. And you can go to bottomshelfbitcoin.com/donate if you want to give financially. But honestly, the biggest thing is just listening to the show and sharing it with other people. It makes a huge difference. So you guys hit me up on Twitter at bottomshelfbtc if there's anything else you'd like to talk about. Next week we will be talking about the Coinbase neutrino hacking team thing. So I'm very excited about that interview. So you guys come back and listen to that. All right. For Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, I'm Josh Humphrey. Thanks for listening.